Before we get started, a warning for anyone with kids in the room. We'll be talking about recreational drug use. There's also some light cursing in this episode. Okay, let's start the show. Back when I was in my 20s, if my friends and I took mushrooms, the psychedelic kind, we'd be at a Grateful Dead concert or at the beach or some other fun venue. But in Oregon these days, there's another way to take a strange trip. And it's run by the state government. It's called Oregon Psilocybin Services.
So people can go to these service centers, as they call them, basically a facility where a trained person will sit with you over the course of a 6 to 8 hour trip. You can have your psilocybin adventure, and then you have a debrief meeting with them afterwards to talk about what happened.
That's Jane Sihu. She recently wrote about the emerging legal psychedelics industry for The Atlantic.
These different centers all have slightly different vibes. I think for the most part, they try to make them feel really homey and comfortable so you aren't just feeling like you're in a doctor's office doing shrooms.
So it's a place you go to when you want a shroom.
Exactly. and the interesting thing about Oregon is that anyone can go. Basically, if you want to have a shroom trip, there's a state legal way to do that in Oregon.
Oregon decriminalized drugs back in 2020. Back in the day, the idea of state-sanctioned psychedelic trips seemed, to borrow some hippie terminology, pretty far out. But with weed now legal in so many states, the calls to do the same for psychedelics are growing louder. There's just one problem. According to Jane, almost no one is happy with the way weed was legalized. While some states have made it easier than ever to purchase cannabis for recreational use, the industry behind it is not exactly thriving. It's rife with inequities and soaring costs. And the legal psychedelics industry seems to be going down the same road.
I think a lot of people feel like this is feeling familiar to them. With cannabis, we had, you know, in the 70s, states starting to consider lowering their punishments for possession of marijuana, starting to decriminalize marijuana. Then in the 90s, you started getting medical programs. In the 2010s, you started seeing recreational programs. And with psychedelics, it's kind of interesting because there are so many states that are doing all of those things at once. So rather than having, like, you know, a wave of decrim, a wave of medical marijuana, a wave of recreational, it feels like with psychedelics, it's just going on all fronts right now.
So would you say that the legalization process with psychedelics is going better so far than it did with marijuana, or is it just going faster?
It might just be going faster. It does seem like a lot of the folks who are working on psychedelics also worked on cannabis. And from talking to those folks, it seems like people are really thinking about, well, what went well with cannabis, what didn't go well with cannabis, and how do we learn from that?
So today on the show, psychedelics are getting legalized fast. We've been here before with cannabis. Can we do better this time around? I'm Emily Peck, filling in for Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about tech, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around. Before we sort of dig into what's happening now, can we just go back in time a little bit? And you can kind of give listeners a sense for how legalization kind of began. You mentioned it started in the 70s with some decriminalization efforts.
Yeah, so some folks might have heard of the Controlled Substances Act, which was passed in the 70s under Nixon, that essentially classified different drugs. And so marijuana, as well as psychedelics, were classified as Schedule I drugs, meaning that they had high potential for abuse and no medically accepted use. And so as soon as that passed, basically, there were states like California that were already looking to try and pass their own decriminalization efforts so that they could at least have access to it in the state or have lower penalties for it, that kind of went against federal law. And in the 90s, I think especially with HIV/AIDS in the conversation, there were a lot of efforts to make medical marijuana available to people. And that spread steadily over the next couple of decades. And then really it was the 2010s that we saw the first states trying to roll out recreational programs.
Right now, 24 states have legalized cannabis for recreational use, and even more allow it for medical use. But weed is still illegal at the federal level. And this patchwork situation creates a lot of confusion.
That's kind of an issue with the state-by-state approach, is that it's state-by-state. So everyone can kind of do their own thing, and it's really hard to know what's going on, even for people who are paying attention. I think people are confused about the state of legality because a lot of folks, you know, if they have a source of receiving marijuana, they are pretty likely to stay the course because that's just kind of the path of least resistance. And folks, unless you're kind of a policy wonk, don't always know exactly what is legal in their state.
Before you could just get weed at a store, buying cannabis, like any illegal activity, was risky, even dangerous. A lot of people were locked up, imprisoned, because of this drug. Now, in some states, buying weed is like picking up a six-pack. It's accessible, safe, and easier than ever. And you don't feel like a criminal doing it. So I asked Jane, what's the problem with legalization?
Sure, there are some people who might be happy with it or who might be excited that they can buy weed. But if you're looking at the actual rollout of the program as a whole, it definitely has equity problems, for one. Some of the more recent stats are unfortunately from 2017, but showed that a lot of the folks who were disproportionately most affected by the war on drugs, specifically Black folks, Latinx folks, there are like single-digit owners of cannabis businesses, of people of those races. People are concerned that this piecemeal state-by-state process has kind of created a mess in that it does not really motivate the federal government to do anything that might create a more unified system and reduce some of that confusion. And also, I think a lot of folks are honestly just disappointed that there isn't really any medical research currently showing anything about how cannabis can be used as treatment. So even though, you know, there are medical marijuana programs available, the actual evidence is still scant just because, you know, people aren't putting the money in. And I think that there's some concern that we are dashing the opportunity to actually study this drug more.
The business of legal weed is not a thriving one. In states where recreational cannabis is allowed, big corporations dominate the industry, while smaller entrepreneurs struggle to break through a high cost of entry. And since weed is still illegal at the federal level, banks often won't work with people in the industry, effectively locking these businesses out of the traditional financial system. This leads to varying costs for both the businesses and the consumers.
For instance, in Oregon, often there are huge surpluses, which is really great for the consumer in that you can buy super cheap weed, but it's not so great for the growers because they just have an excess of product across the state and they have to sell it more cheaply than maybe they would want to. And I know that in other states, the prices are high enough that folks are just turning to the black market or the underground because, you know, it's like they have their weed guy and their weed guy has been pretty consistent and don't have to deal with the overhead of running a business and state regulations. And so I guess one other thing on the lack of federal buy-in that is an issue for these state cannabis businesses is that because selling marijuana is still federally illegal, these folks who have cannabis businesses can't write off usual business expenses. And so folks are concerned that that is going to further reduce who can really even get into this business and afford to stay in it.
I mean, a lot of these inequities are, they just sound so familiar. They're like the kind of things that you encounter in most businesses, right? Like people of color, Black people, Hispanic people have more hurdles to owning businesses, things like that. It's kind of an interesting thing going from the Black market to a more regulated market. You get like new corporate-y type problems.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, and then there are folks who kind of hate the corporate side of it too, right? And I think this kind of plays into this thesis of not everyone is happy. I think folks feel weird that you can go into like a really slick little store and pay maybe more than you did before for weed. And I mean, I guess also the same thing is happening for psychedelics in that folks are really split on how they feel about all these various avenues for accessing it. I mean, some folks, they say, I don't want to go to a service center. Like being watched during a trip sounds like the least fun thing imaginable. Yeah. And so, you know, some folks just want decrim where they are like, I just want to grow my mushrooms in peace and do them in peace by myself. But then, you know, you've got regulators, folks at the state level, folks at the federal level too, who are like, yeah, like sure, but there are real safety issues with just letting people do that potentially. Depends on the drug, depends on how much you take. Of course, it's always been a problem. But, you know, I've talked to folks who have lost kids from, you know, not having proper harm reduction or education about this type of stuff. And I mean, I think earlier in my life, I might have been like, well, you know, like so many of us just basically fucked around and found out. But I don't know that that's necessarily the best way to go about it either. So it's a really tricky problem in that folks have all sorts of different opinions about it. And it's a real careful balance of how much regulation and what kind. And no one's going to be perfectly happy in the end, but trying to figure out the right thing to do is tricky.
When we come back, how the push for legal psychedelics could be different. Was a big year for drugs. In Oregon, voters overwhelmingly approved a ballot measure to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of hard drugs, including fentanyl, heroin, cocaine, meth, and psychedelics. The measure included new investments in addiction treatment and support services, a move heralded by drug reform advocates. But 3.5 years later, public sentiment has started to shift against the legislation. The Oregon legislature recently introduced a bill that would essentially undo the decriminalization from 2020. But Jane thinks that psychedelics aren't the focus here.
It feels somewhat unlikely that psychedelics are going to be what get prosecuted in this situation. It really feels like that's maybe more a way that the state wants to reclaim some ability to prosecute people for fentanyl use and try and get a hold of that drug problem. And I mean, I think with psychedelics, it's always kind of been the case that who actually gets prosecuted, you know, who actually faces consequence for use or possession is very dependent on socioeconomic status and race and, you know, lots of other things. So I don't know that we can expect to see a huge amount of change there, but it does feel like an interesting contradiction that in a state where you have a full up and running psilocybin services program, you might also technically have it be a criminal offense to use psilocybin again.
So it seems like just hearing you kind of parse this out, and it's already a little bit complicated, it seems like we're headed down the same road with psychedelics as we were with cannabis.
A little bit. And I mean, I think it's interesting because we've been with psychedelics in this big hype bubble. People for many years were really excited about the potential for psychedelics, just a lot of excitement about the possible medical use of it as therapeutic stuff, just the possibility that it could become more widely available for recreational use. And I think we are really hitting the point where that hype bubble might be bursting a little bit and folks are starting to think about what that functionally looks like in your community, if we're ready for that as a society. It still has a lot of stigma to overcome. And I think people sometimes, especially folks who are kind of involved in that world, forget that there are still plenty of people who are quite uncomfortable with that kind of open drug use.
I was listening to an interview where an Indigenous man was talking about how psychedelics have been used for, you know, hundreds of years among his people. And it's weird to think of them becoming, you know, run by the government and corporatized. Is there a way to address these concerns in legalization? Are people talking about it or thinking about it?
People are talking about it and thinking about it for sure. Whether anything is functionally changing is an open question. And I think that is a really important conversation to have. I think that, yeah, a lot of people are really uncomfortable with the idea that you could only access it through like medical means, for instance. There are some folks who, like you mentioned, Indigenous people who have been using some of these substances for, you know, since time immemorial, as part of ceremonies. And those folks, in some cases, you know, might have access through like religious exemption. So for instance, like the Native American Church is allowed to access peyote, but it's tricky. I mean, there's also the question of even just folks who have been working in the underground for decades. So, you know, we talked about this Oregon psilocybin program. That state-regulated program sets up rules for what facilitators have to do to go through training to be able to sit with people during their trips. And in some cases, you know, like folks who have been doing this for decades are like, yeah, I already know all this stuff. Like, do I really have to pay for like a several thousand dollar training and then pay for like a several thousand dollar license in order to do what I'm already doing? Mm-hmm. But just in a legal way through the legal program.
It seems like on the one hand, going state by state with legalization is a way to sort of incubate a lot of different ideas. And like, it's a great like trial and error process. Do you think that's right? Like, is that the best way to be cautious and deliberate about legalization?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that there's any other way, honestly. Like, either way, it feels like there are some people who are charging ahead who are like, you know, let's throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. And if it breaks, then we'll fix it. And then there are other people who are like, that is unacceptable. We need to think through every possible scenario and make sure this is really safe and ready to roll out first.
One area where psychedelics differ from cannabis is in medical use. While there are a few specific medical programs for cannabis, there's little evidence of how it can be used as a treatment. But the pharmaceutical industry sees psychedelics as a potential treatment for serious mental health issues. Recently, the FDA accepted a new drug application from a company called Lykos Therapeutics for MDMA to treat people with post-traumatic stress disorder.
This application that was put in, I think, right at the end of last year, the FDA went back to them and said, we're going to fast track your application and we'll tell you by August whether or not we agree that you should get FDA approval for MDMA to treat PTSD specifically. MDMA, which some people might know as Molly or ecstasy back in the day, it is a psychedelic that is kind of neck and neck with psilocybin, I think, in terms of people's excitement and the amount of research that has been done on whether it might be able to treat mental health issues. But yeah, it feels like if that FDA approval for MDMA happens, that is going to really force some federal changes potentially. So some folks have wondered whether that means that whether all of MDMA is going to be rescheduled from Schedule 1 to, you know, a lesser restriction. Some folks think that it might not be all MDMA that gets rescheduled. It might only be the specific type that was put forth by this company. But if MDMA, even just the kind that the application was put in for, is rescheduled, I do think that that kind of opens the door for other folks to say, well, clearly, if the definition of Schedule 1 is that it has no medically accepted use, then the government's ruling on this feels like it is at odds with its own previous ruling. So what are we going to do about that?
Does a drug have to have a therapeutic use to be decriminalized? I mean, cannabis started out people saying, you know, it actually has medical, you know, medical purpose. And now you hear again with psychedelics, like we can use it to treat PTSD. We can use it to treat anxiety. And that's all for the good. Like I'm all for treating those things however we can. But I mean, can't we just legalize psychedelics because they're fun and relatively harmless?
If you're asking me, I think that is a good enough reason. And I mean, there are definitely advocates and folks who have been working in the space for a long time who think that people should have access to any kind of drug they want. And that, in fact, if that is the case, there are more chances to test those drugs and to make sure that they're safe and regulated so that people hopefully are not, you know, doing tainted drugs and dying. However, not everyone thinks that way. And I think that, honestly, the medical or therapeutic angle sits better with people. I think it feels more convincing to some corners of the world where people are a little reticent to endorse drug use of any kind, especially drugs that have for decades been demonized as, you know, brain scrambling or, I mean, I'm just thinking of that, like, Rachel Lee Cook ad that I saw as a kid that compared your brain to a scrambled egg if you did drugs.
This is your brain. This is drugs. This is your brain on drugs.
So I think there's a lot of stigma to contend with, and making the argument that these drugs might be able to help people who are in real pain, who don't have great treatments for their ailments otherwise. I think some folks are like, why not give this a shot?
Well, Jane, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Jane C. Hugh is a journalist and the author of the newsletter, The Microdose. And that's it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell, Anna Phillips, and Patrick Fort. Our show is edited by Paige Osborne. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio for Slate. TBD is part of the larger What Next family. And if you're a fan of the show, I have a request for you. Become a Slate Plus member. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. We'll be back next week with more episodes. I'm Emily Peck, and you can catch me every Saturday on Slate Money. Thanks for listening.